Come and Get It is the highly anticipated new novel from New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Kylie Reid. A fresh and provocative story about a college RA and her messy entanglement with a professor and three unruly students. Come and Get It is an intimate portrait of consumption, desire, and reckless abandon. Look for Come and Get It, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
Does Joe Nesbo always know the ending of his books before he starts? He'll join us to talk about his latest novel, The Kingdom. And I promise, no spoilers. How do you capture the long and incredibly accomplished life of Eleanor Roosevelt in a single-volume biography? David Michaelis will be here to discuss his latest book, Eleanor. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's December 11th. I'm Pamela Paul. Joe Nesbo joins us now from Oslo. His new book is called The Kingdom. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I want to say something up front to our listeners who come from around the world, because I can hear some of you saying it's you, Nesbo, and they're going to say that it's Harry Hula. But Joe's dad actually grew up in Brooklyn. And Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, you grew up being called Joe at home, correct?
Yeah, at least he called me Joe.
Okay, so we are pronouncing it the American way with awareness, even though I did practice the Norwegian.
You did well.
Thank you. All right, let's talk about the book. And I want to talk about it, if you could tell us a little bit about it without spoiling or revealing anything at all.
The theme of the book is brothers. There's two brothers, Roy, who is the older brother, who is more this introvert character, not doing that well at school. And his younger brother, Carl, is more the extrovert, likable, popular guy doing well at school. They grew up in this small town in the mountains of Norway. And their parents die when they are in their early teens from what seems to be a car accident. Later on, Carl moves to the United States to study business administration. And 15 years later, he comes back to the small village. And Roy is at this time running the local gas station. Carl is coming back with a big plan for the whole village, which is building a luxurious spa hotel in which everyone in the village will participate as investors. That is his big plan. And he's also bringing his new wife, Shannon, so they move in with Roy. As this progresses with the plan for the hotel, dark secrets from the past starts rising to the surface.
All right, and we're not revealing any of those secrets. Where do you start with a book like this? Does it begin for you with the characters, with the idea of brothers, with the feeling of like, I am not writing a Harry Hole novel this time? Like, where do you begin?
This novel definitely started with the theme of brothers. I grew up with a brother who is 1 year younger than me, Knut, which I was very close to. We like the brothers in the kingdom. We shared a room and a bunk bed. And we played football together for many, many years. And later on, when I moved back to Oslo, where we grew up, he moved here too, and we started the band together. And we played in that band until he passed away. So we were always very close. And it's not like this is a novel that is a keyhole looking into the real relationship of me and Knut, but I definitely draw on the experience and our emotional bonds in this novel. I think it's also generally about family. It's in my previous novels, I've been subconsciously focusing on son-father relationships, but here it's brothers, but also family in general, the loyalty, the obligation you feel toward a family, and of course, the dilemma of following the rules of society and following the unwritten rules of the family, which is sometimes, especially in this case, in conflict.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, because I think most people, when they think of your recurring main character, Harry Hole, probably don't think about family and relationships.
That's partly true. He has a younger sister towards which he feels responsible, but he doesn't have a brother. And I think maybe that subconsciously was something I did to remove him more from my own person and my situation. I knew that at some point I would have to address the theme of brothers, because it's been there my whole life. It's been such a big part of my life.
In an interview with The Times in 2012, you said that you were increasingly tired of Harry Hole, and that sometimes you found your books with Hole to be very dark. And I, you know, very dark is definitely how I would describe them. I'm curious what qualifies as very dark in your book, because this book is not lighthearted, the Kingdom, even without Hole.
I guess there's less physical brutality in this book. There's less violence, but there's, I think, maybe more psychological abuse and psychological violence. But I mean, hate is the flip side of the coin to love. So I think it's impossible to write about hate, violence, revenge without keeping one eye on love, which is the case here. It's a love story turning bad. It's I was asked to come up with a sort of a tagline for the novel, and it was two brothers and one woman.
You mentioned earlier that your brother Knut was in a band with you. I don't know if all your American fans here know that you were a rock star before you became a writer, not like the usual trajectory. I'm curious if that experience informs your writing in some way, or did writing feel like a real escape from that?
It's partly more or less the same thing. I mean, it's I see myself mainly as a storyteller. Playing in that band, I was the worst musician in the band. the rest of the guys, they are really good musicians. But I could write songs and I could write stories. So that was sort of my ticket to be in a band. So in that respect, it's, I guess, me writing lyrics for my band, pop songs of 3.5 minutes. That was sort of my school for writing in general, and even for writing novels, because I can remember when I started writing my first novel, I thought it was about trying to fill 200 or 300 pages with words. While writing lyrics, it's the opposite. You have to trust your listeners to fill in the blank spaces and to use their imagination and intelligence to write the rest of the story. And then I realized that writing novels, it's exactly the same. You can only give your readers directions in which to explore the story, and so they have to sort of direct 90% of the move themselves.
All right, here's another thing that, again, might feel incongruous to some of your readers. You were also, in addition to being a rock star before being a writer, a stockbroker. Do you feel like a stockbroker who became a rock star who became a writer? Do you feel like all three of these things? How do those different periods of your life work in your mind?
I was a stockbroker. I actually worked in finance for 9 years, but I was not a happy stockbroker. I was not an enthusiastic stockbroker. I was more of a reluctant stockbroker, but who realized that this pays the rent and more. When I quit working as a stockbroker, I didn't have a career as a writer. I could probably live playing with a band, but I didn't feel like a full-time musician either. So I quit partly because I wanted to pursue writing novels, trying to get published, and partly because I was really tired of being a stockbroker. But I really, in hindsight, I really appreciate the experience of having had a sort of a, let's call it, normal working life, that I know what it is getting up early in the morning and having to work regular hours.
I mean, you've had tremendous success as a novelist, so you might be the only former stockbroker and rock star who like really made money by becoming a writer.
When I quit as a stockbroker, I had calculated that I had enough money so I didn't have to make any money for 5 years. So I gave myself 5 years in which to create something that I was happy with and hopefully get published. What happened, much to my surprise, was that 3 weeks after I quit my job, they phoned me from a publishing house and said that we read your script, we want to publish it. So it didn't take 5 years.
How long does it usually take you to write a book?
It all depends. The Red Breast, my third novel, and also this, The Kingdom, took really long. I guess The Kingdom took around 3 years from, I didn't do it full time, but from start till finish, 3 years. But the novel Headhunters, that most people maybe know as the movie Headhunters, that probably took me 2 months.
Do you always know when you start a novel where it's going to end?
Well, if you... by start a novel mean when I write like chapter one and the first sentence of the novel. Yeah, by then I've probably written a long synopsis for The Kingdom, probably a synopsis of 100 pages where I have the plot, the places, notes on the atmosphere, research, and also to me very important bits and pieces of dialogue that so I sort of knows how my characters walk and talk. I find that is the tricky part, and that is where you may be surprised as a writer, is that you have planned for a character to be in a certain way, and when you make them walk and talk, they won't obey the plan you have for them. Yes, the answer is I like to, when I write chapter one, to be able to tell my readers, you know, come closer, sit down and listen carefully, because I have this great story to tell you and you can trust me. I know exactly where we're going.
So when you said synopsis, I thought you were going to say 100 words, not 100 pages. That's quite a synopsis. I mean, that's more than an outline. Do you then go and sort of work in that same, I just have to ask these mechanical questions because it's unusual. Do you work in that same document and kind of fill it out, or do you start completely over and rewrite what you've got in that 100 pages, but from scratch?
I have it sort of at the bottom of the script. So I start writing on top of it. And then I skip down to the synopsis and I delete what I've been through.
I'm asking a lot of process questions, but it's always really fascinating for people who don't write fiction, kind of how it works. I mean, do you have a routine? Are you waking up early in the morning and writing? Are you a late night writer?
I have very little structure. When I started writing, I would write mostly at night. Then I realized that the work that I did just after getting out of bed was better than my work at night. So I started working in the morning instead. And then as I started traveling for publishing in other countries, I didn't really have a routine day any longer. So I would just have to fit in the writing. And it's still like that a little bit, that writing is something I do when I have nothing else to do. So I don't really have a regular work day.
Something you fit in between errands.
Exactly. More or less, you know, it's... I started writing because I wanted the freedom. It would sort of be a bit strange if I would, after finally, you know, getting rid of a regular work day, would give myself 9 to 5 work.
Getting rid of the regular work day, getting rid of that whole rock star thing, or pushing it at least to the side. In America, a lot of people, or maybe just me, like to think of Scandinavia as this like incredible swath of the world where everything is wonderful and happy, except for Nordic noir. And in that space, sort of everything is very dark and tragic and gory. And I wonder what it looks like from inside all of that. If you just think, like, if this just whole perception that we have of Scandinavia is this kind of bifurcated, everything is great, and then there's this fictional world of death. Does it just have no bearing on reality in Scandinavia itself, in Norway?
There's probably been more homicides in the Harry Hole series during the last 20 years than it has been in Oslo in the same period. So it doesn't really reflect actual society and actual crime rate. I think it's interesting that readers will probably understand the context of a homicide in a city where there are almost no homicides. It's like more of a shock to the system. basically, my stories are not about real crime or trying to describe a realistic Oslo. Although the Oslo in the Harry Hole series, it is a real Oslo, but it's sort of slightly twisted. It's a Gotham City version of Oslo. So I use, and I guess other crime writers in Scandinavia also, use the crime novel as a framework for telling stories about anything, you know, about, of course, the Scandinavian tradition of crime writing is that you criticize society and you focus on social issues. I do that too, I guess. Not like I have a political agenda in that respect, but I think it's impossible to write anything without at some level being political. I mean, just in describing, physically describing a city, you will have to edit. You will have to decide what is important to describe and what is not. And in making those choices, you are political.
Well, I think in the better crime novels, at least in my opinion, you know, the characters are imbued with their own views that are often political. You know, in your work, in the work of Tana French, for example, people have points of view.
I think my technique of cautiously, I guess, expressing my own opinions are to give different characters different points of views. So it's kind of a back and forth. Storytelling in general is about conflict, and conflicting views on basic values are an endless source for writers.
Does the term Nordic noir overgeneralize Scandinavian crime writing? I mean, I imagine as a Norwegian, I assume, maybe I'm wrong, that you see your work as, you know, and the work of fellow Norwegians is probably very different from the work of Swedes or Danish writers.
I do, yeah. Like you said, seen from the inside, it's we're different writers. But I guess seen from the outside, we can't deny that there are probably certain features that we share. Like I said, my father grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And so when he moved back to Norway with my grandparents, they took with them American culture. So I grew up with Mark Twain and Fenimore Cooper and American literature just as much as Norwegian and Scandinavian literature. And I guess that stayed with me. So I probably write in a style that has one foot in the Scandinavian tradition of the Swedish writers Sjöwall and Wahle, who sort of started the trend of the Scandinavian noir in the 70s, and the other foot in the, I guess, hard-boiled American detective novel of the 50s and 60s, especially with a writer like Jim Thompson.
Do you still read American fiction?
I do, yes, definitely.
Which American authors do you like reading?
Oh, I like a lot of writers. Cormac McCarthy, I read recently, and he's just great, probably my favorite for the time being. Infinite Jest with Wallace. I mean, I just love the diversity of American literature. I mean, in smaller countries, you can see certain trends in literature, and everybody gets on that wagon. But I think that it seems in American literature, maybe they are just seen from the outside, that there are trends that people will join, but there are just that many trends, but it just looks more diverse from the outside.
Right. No, we're actually all alike, just like all the Scandinavians are. Are you working on another novel now?
Right now, I'm actually working on some short stories, a collection of crime short stories first, and then after that, a collection of science fiction short stories.
Oh, wow. So very much a departure.
Yes, it is. And talking about American literature, I was a big fan, I'm still a big fan of Ray Bradbury and his short stories in science fiction. So I guess it's no secret that science fiction short story collection is inspired by Ray Bradbury.
All right. Well, something more to look forward to. Joe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Joe Nesbo's latest novel is called The Kingdom.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. David Michaelis joins us now from outside New York. His latest book is a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. It's called Eleanor. David, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. This is not the obvious third biography for you, following Charles M. Schulz and N.C. Wyeth. Why Eleanor?
Actually, it was logical. I wanted to find a life that was an entirely democratic life. And by that, I mean that both books that I had written before were, you could call them access biography, meaning to write them, I gained the access and confidence and trust of families to write them. Eleanor Roosevelt is a figure of our history and democracy who left all her papers to the American people in the FDR Presidential Library. That's not really a good enough reason. The real reason was I wanted to fall in love again.
You met her when you were very young.
I was 4, and my mother was her producer on a very early public television program out of WGBH in Boston. She was on the set. I happened to be Diana Michaelis, my mother's, you know, little 4-year-old child bobbling around. And I think in my, my memory is of crossing paths with her, where cables and so forth were running across the set and looking up, and there was this beatific, saintly figure with a cloud of white hair leaning down. And I think I thought I should ask her for something. I think Eleanor Roosevelt inspired that in people. Everyone wanted something from her, and I wanted juicy fruit gum. She was fresh out, and what I got from this momentary encounter, literally of the moment, was truly a sense that goodness was pouring out of this human being.
Did you keep hold of that sense of goodness throughout the process of writing this biography of her?
Well, she's a complicated figure, of course. And when you get close to her, you discover that she herself was using goodness in her early life to counteract the effects of a childhood of shame and humiliation growing out of her father's addiction and alcoholism and her mother's narcissism. That's a short, reductive version of her parents, but they had a great struggle themselves in leading adult lives. And Eleanor struggled to find love ever after her parents died when she was 9 years old. She was left orphaned.
It is interesting that from a position today, people might look at a figure like Eleanor Roosevelt and think, here is a person of great privilege. So, of course, she was able to do these things without understanding just how miserable a childhood she had. So just tell us, give us a story, a sense of what the effects of her parents and the situation she was raised in.
Eleanor Roosevelt's father was in a state of collapse toward the end of his life. And in a moment that she ever after remembered was when her father had broken a leg during a sort of society circus in the, you know, in some great estate in Connecticut, at Shore of Connecticut. he broke his leg during a circus where he was riding around on a horse. And the doctor misdiagnosed the break. It had to be reset as he was taken out of the house. She stood like a figure out of Dickens with enormous pity and enormous sorrow and compassion, grief building in her to the point of helplessness that had defined most of this experience she'd had. She had also been close with her father. And once he was taken out of the house that day, she felt as if he never came back. She saw him again. She saw him into her 10th year. But he was always spinning a kind of grandiose version of what the life they would have together. And oddly enough, the version that she took from it, a kind of dream life that she lived after his death in her mind, in her imagination, was of taking care of a very powerful Roosevelt man who was handicapped, and yet somehow together they would go around the world, changing the world and doing things together. In a way, it was a sort of microcosm projection of the life that she actually did finally create for herself with Franklin Roosevelt. That's the odd part of Eleanor Roosevelt's life, is that from the tragedy of her childhood, she actually formed some of the elements of her later greatness.
So Eleanor Roosevelt marries Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obviously, we all have heard about this marriage. We think of it, I think, generally as an unhappy marriage, but it was complicated. Can you tell us a little bit about their relationship?
Well, she was a continuous pursuer of truth, and she wanted to, in her own personal life, feel a sense of intimacy and belonging, as we all do. I think in her case, it was probably even more extreme. And Franklin Roosevelt was a born deceiver, simply because he had been born an only child, his mother's favorite, a sort of a sun child, sun god, I always thought of him as. He, in order to get what he needed, though, in this very intense relationship he has with his mother, he learned how to tell white lies and learned how to move around behind her and to get what he needed and wanted, especially in the sense that he needed to establish his own individuality. This was a mother who followed him to college, lived near him, and could barely recognize Eleanor at first, even though they were cousins. Eleanor felt very strongly when she met Franklin that she was going to be on solid ground again. But in a way, their relationship was built on this complete incompatibility of personality. They had very different aims, and yet they also had a great sense. I think what was in common for both of them was that they understood, both of them, that courage, taking life's challenges and facing them straight on, was always more exhilarating, I guess is the word, than fear. They were fearless, both of them. They both lived lives without fear, and it's one of the reasons you see why Franklin and Eleanor worked together as a partnership, even when their marriage and their intimacy and their intimate life didn't work.
How much love was there in the marriage?
Out of the enormous respect that I think never ended for both of them in each other, there was created a love that also would encompass a very modern, very new, contemporary kind of, I think, idea of marriage, which is a marriage of great tolerance and understanding that the other might have needs that one could not fulfill. And I think that was Eleanor's continuous sense in her own life of adapting, that you're not going to be able to do everything. You have to figure out what you can do and then do it very, very well.
How did she take FDR's infidelity?
Hard, shocked, and incredibly hurt. And that hurt, I think, never left her entirely. She was a person who remembered always. She moved on. She was not a woman who lived in the past, ever. But she always would say, you know, I can forgive, but I never forget. She did forgive. And I think she moved on, recognizing, as especially polio, which struck Franklin Roosevelt only 3 years after the affair with Lucy Mercer that Eleanor discovered and was so terribly hurt by. Polio, in a sense, freed them both because it gave Franklin Roosevelt a lifelong goal, which was to walk again, to become president, somehow to triumph over this as if it had never stopped him, and it never really did. But it allowed Eleanor to recognize she wasn't going to be the key to his cure. There was no real cure to polio. You simply found ways of adapting to it, and you did what you could do every day. She, I think, recognized in Franklin that he would never be who he was going to be. He could never be Franklin Roosevelt without being able to be free to try something that seemed impossible, to become president of the United States when you were what was called in those days a cripple. But their triumph together was not a triumph of denial. They didn't deny this. They simply would not let it stop them. And I think that's always in the Roosevelt. I mean, the Roosevelts are sort of a story machine. You know, they fit our different national ideas about ourselves at different times. And I think the story that Eleanor told Franklin and Franklin himself told the world was, nothing will stop you if you don't let it stop you. You know, Eleanor's great line, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. It's all about self-actualization in both their cases. And they became individuals that way. I mean, I think that's really the part of democracy that Eleanor and Franklin both stand for, is that the part where they say, remember, you know, always that you have the not only the right to be an individual, but the obligation to be one.
I want to get to her work, but I have one more relationship question, and it's the obvious one. We talked about Lucy Mercer. One area of perpetual and maybe increasing interest is her relationship with Lorena Hickok. Who is Hick? And, you know, there's been so many books sort of, did they or did they not have a romantic and physical relationship? Where do you come down on all that?
Well, Hick was the star reporter for AP. She was herself a character of the late 20s and early 30s. She'd covered the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. She'd covered all these huge stories. She was covering Franklin Roosevelt's run for the presidency, and she and Eleanor fell in love during the campaign. If you read her, as I did, if you read every word of her letters, they are the surviving letters of that relationship. They are authentic. They are at the FDR Library. You can read them. You cannot deny that there is a powerful bond between these two, and you would have to understand it as a sexual bond, lest you simply deny that these two people had sexual lives, had an erotic component to them. There's a part of Eleanor that always wanted closeness, as I've mentioned, but there's a part of her that wanted what you wanted, and I think she wanted what Hick wanted. And Hick was a far more defined, by today's sense of identity, sexual identity, was far more defined as a lesbian. She was living queer life. She understood that this was her own version of how she was going to live her life. And Eleanor, I don't think, would have been able to say that. I don't think that's part of what she was saying. But I think she was saying, I want to be with you and I love you dearly. You are my closest. And that bond, we see it. Eleanor was terrified of becoming First Lady because it was going to define her as a public person and that she would have to deny her private life. This was absolutely offset by the fact that she had just fallen in love with Lorena Hickok. And all the first days in the White House, all the days of drama of FDR's first 100 days and the banking crisis and the Roosevelts trying immediately to help the country through the worst of the Depression, was Eleanor falling in love with this star reporter.
We often talk about, you know, FDR having been the longest serving president in our history, but less so about Eleanor Roosevelt as the longest standing first lady. What was her experience in that position like, and did it change over time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a 12-year arc from the time Eleanor Roosevelt became first lady in 1933, March 4, 1933, to the day she left the White House in April 19th, 1945. And would recommend a close study of it someday, because it is one of those most fascinating things to see a woman who arrives at the White House, not only afraid that she's going to be categorized now as a traditional tea-pouring first lady, she who had by that time become a politician in her own right through the women's division of the Democratic Party and through party politics in New York State as the first lady of New York State. And she says to Franklin as she comes into the White House, what can I do? Tell me, give me a job. I'll do your mail for you. No, no, no is the answer. All she got at first was no. And it was actually a very early event in May of that year where she went out to the Bonus Army. A second group of protesters, U.S. veterans, had arrived in the Capitol asking for the bonus that they deserved, asking to be taken care of and seen. And there they sat in their tent camp in Anacostia, following a disaster that had ended, certainly helped elect FDR the previous year when Hoover had sent the army to a very similar group of protesters. The Bonus Army, first Bonus Army, arrived in Washington, built a tent camp, and Hoover sent the army. MacArthur, Eisenhower were sent with troops, and they shot on, fired upon U.S. veterans. They ran them out of Washington, D.C., and when Eleanor was taken with Louis Howe, took her in a car out to the camp, the second camp of Bonus Marchers in May of 33, now as First Lady, saying to her, you go in there and talk to them. And she looked at him and said, well, me? What am I going to say to these men? Just go ahead. And Louis Howe then took a nap in the backseat of the car, and Eleanor went into this camp and immediately began talking to the first man she saw. And within minutes, a crowd of men had gathered around her, and within 20 minutes, half an hour, they were singing songs from the First World War that she remembered from her own service in a Red Cross camp canteen in Union Station. She made such an impression on these men who felt understood, who felt heard, who felt seen. The next day's headline in the Washington newspapers was a quote from one of the men saying, Hoover sent the army, Roosevelt sent his wife. And this became the sort of signature of, you know, people came to see the president, Eleanor came to see you. She made the first lady into a mobile job. She had velocity. She was unstoppable. And she used the technology of the day always, whether it was radio or newsreels. She learned how to use the automobile as first lady of New York, driving herself everywhere. And now as first lady, she traversed the country, became the first lady to cross the country by air. People could look up, hearing the sound of an airplane and think that the first lady of the United States was flying overhead to some place. And in the depths of the Depression, that was a sense of anything might be possible. If she's up there, if she's going somewhere, if she's doing something, well, then we can too, by God.
She wrote a lot, obviously, columns, books, how to, you know, life advice. Was it a process for her to kind of find her own voice and have confidence in it?
It's the key to her, actually, because this is a young woman. When she was a young woman, she believed that she had nothing to say and that she, in fact, was forbidden to say anything. And that actually you really weren't supposed to say very much at all. And in fact, as a young girl in her days as a society, you know, debutante and so forth, she had to learn tricks of how to talk to people and what kind of conversation, even to the point of using A, B, C, D, E, F, you know, oh, ants, Mr. So-and-so, are you afraid of any absurd kind of conversational gambits? From that to a woman who began making timorous and stammering speeches to raise money for the women's part of the Democratic Party, to being able to suddenly raise money, suddenly a voice that would raise into high-pitched giggles and glissando, you know, sort of slide whistle effects, and she got that under control. She was endlessly controlling and perfecting her voice. It was always her, though. She never created one of those phony voices from the way Hollywood movie stars were often trained to kind of create a British English-sounding voice. Eleanor's voice was always her own. She never tried to be anything other than what she was, but she brought it deeper, actually, into her chest, into her diaphragm, and she began to learn how to actually use technique of breathing and so forth to create a voice that was much calmer and much actually more restrained than the sort of popular idea of her with this high-pitched, giggly voice.
Let's pause for a moment and listen to Eleanor speak.
Many of you all over this country have boys in the services who will now be called upon to go into action. You have friends and families in what has suddenly become a danger zone. You cannot escape anxiety. You cannot escape a clutch of fear at your heart. And yet I hope that the certainty of what we have to meet will make you rise above these fears.
Given how much Eleanor did eventually write, that must have been challenging for you as a biographer. I mean, did you read all of it?
It's a mind-blowing amount of material. If you start looking at the million documents, that's letters and papers and so forth in her FDR library. But then if you go to the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers Project and even begin to see the digital massiveness of her column, and the column she wrote every day from 1935 to 1962, taking only 4 days off.
I mean, every day is insane.
Insane. And
it's
also
insane.
It's a live blog. And so it's her thoughts as they are coming out very fresh of the moment. And I actually reveled in that and would read as much of her column as I could. It's very hard to read her letters in some ways because they tend, first of all, her handwriting is atrocious. Oh. You have to learn how to do that first, although a lot of it was typed, thank heavens. But there's a quality to her writing where she's writing 20 thank you notes at night. That's going to be repetitive. What I learned was to focus entirely on the day itself. And I often would look at the day I was in that part of the year and noticed how much of nature and how much of her own imagination she lived in, which was always a reward. But her books are magnificent, and her writing is this sort of plain style, kind of like Ulysses Grant describing the Civil War. It's a very plain style. It's very simple. It's clear. It's not written to impress. It's written to profoundly impress you with your own responsibility for each of these things that she's talking about. And you feel it. You feel connected.
I know. I wish more young people would read her books, like You Learn by Living, her sort of books of advice and her autobiographies. A lot of it really holds up.
Well, and a lot of it has seeped out, actually, from the books into the culture through, I noticed often that entire, you know, Instagram feeds and web pages were given over to Eleanor Roosevelt Wisdom, which you do find in You Learn by Living, a great book, by the way. But, you know, these ideas that, you know, the future does belong to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. There she's encouraging you to use your imagination, that anything is possible. She is a figure of that world of inspiration that's out there, very vague in a very large and massive way. But also, I think coming back to the books, you do see her thinking these things through at first. And it's very exciting because she's growing herself. She's a figure of growth, always, always growing.
If there's one thing you really want your readers to understand or to consider anew about Eleanor Roosevelt, what would it be?
Oh, I think the profound sense of her own life, which shows that we're human only through the humanity of other people. She became more human to herself the more she connected with others and did things for others in service of others. And that might simply be a moment of contact with someone where both felt each other's humanity. I mean, if you ever sense that, you know, sort of, you know, you feel a catch in your throat when you sing the Star Spangled Banner, or when you meet somebody on a train and you both have so much in common, even though you come from different places, that kind of feeling of the of brotherhood, sisterhood, of familyhood that you can have with people in the world was Eleanor Roosevelt's life. That's what it was about. It was about love for all people.
Well, you can't read enough about Eleanor Roosevelt, as far as I'm concerned. So, David, congratulations on such a worthy topic and an excellent book.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Michaelis is the author of a new biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, Eleanor. Alexander Alter joins us now with some news from the literary world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela.
What are you going to tell us?
Well, I'm afraid I have some bad news today. It's going to be a huge disappointment to our listeners to hear this, but a major literary prize has been canceled. The Bad Sex in Fiction Award was canceled this year. I know it's been given out every year for decades, but this year the judges said in a statement that they felt the public had been subjected to too many bad things this year to justify exposing it to bad sex as well. It continued to say that the cancellation of the 2020 award should not be taken as a license to write bad sex. So that's a warning to all the novelists out there.
I feel like, why this year?
Why this year? I feel like we could have actually used the entertainment this year, particularly after Book Expo was canceled for 2021 and beyond. The organizers of the largest trade show in the United States for publishers and librarians and booksellers have said that they're going to discontinue it, and they said they would reimagine it in some fashion. But, you know, the other awards went on virtually, but there have been so many cancellations. So I thought, you know, this carry on this fine tradition. And the prize, you know, obviously it's very tongue in cheek and it's, you know, almost a parody, but it has gone to some pretty well-known prominent authors in the past. Ben Okri was given the Bad Sex in Fiction Award 1 year for a scene that featured a rocket going off. And John Updike received the Lifetime Achievement Award. And Salman Rushdie and Stephen King and Haruki Murakami have all been nominated on the shortlist. So, you know, a lot of authors think it is a little bit cruel and can kind of intimidate people, discourage them from writing about sex at all. Mm-hmm. But others have kind of embraced the award with pride and good humor. So, sorry to have to be the bearer of bad news. In other news, it continues to be actually a pretty positive time for the industry, despite all the challenges. The latest NPD figures have shown print sales up more than 7% compared to last year. So, you know, even with these cancellations, a lot of people are still buying books, publishing books, reading books. And I think the holidays will only, I assume, increase that and hopefully lift up the bottom lines of some independent stores as well.
Alexandra, what are you looking forward to reading over the holidays?
I'm really looking forward to a novel that's coming out next year by Caitlin Greenwich called Liberty. I just started it and it's really engrossing and I'm excited to dig into that over the holidays.
Well, her sister, Carrie, was just a guest on the podcast, so.
They are quite a talented family.
There's a third sister, too.
That's right. She's the playwright.
All right, Alexandra, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Tina Jordan and Greg Coles. Hey, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
So, Tina, let's start with you. What are you reading?
I'm reading a book by Leslie Brody called Sometimes You Have to Lie, The Life and Times of Louise Fitzhugh, renegade author of Harriet the Spy. And I loved Harriet the Spy as a kid. It was one of those books I read over and over and over again. And as one of my colleagues pointed out this last week, you know, probably an entire generation of kids who fell in love with this little spy, this little snoop who walked around with her spiral notebook, you know, taking notes on everybody. Like, it's probably why we're all journalists. because remember, she wasn't snooping and eavesdropping and writing down conversations so that she could blackmail people or be mean to them. She was compiling writing material. She was going to write a book. Anyway, so when I saw there was a biography of Louise Fitzhugh, about whom I knew absolutely nothing, I was thrilled. And the biography actually starts with the critical reception for the book, which came out in 1964. And of course, if I'd thought about it, I would have realized that adults hated it. Critics, like, you know, this was a nasty little girl. Whereas I was laughing out loud, you know, when Harriet said things like, I'll be damned if I'm going to dancing school. Parents and educators were horrified. It sold millions of copies its first year. I was stunned. I mean, it was sort of published at exactly the right time. Here was a protest book, but for children. And I've now moved on from the critical reception of the book, and I'm at the point where I'm going through her girlhood and her young adulthood. She grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, the only child of wealthy parents who divorced when she was a baby and fought over her bitterly. She also died very young. She died in her early 30s. And as I'm going through this book, one of the things that seems clear to me is that the reason we knew so little about her was that her friends were so protective of her when she died because they were afraid that outing her, telling people that she was gay, would hurt her reputation. And so nobody would talk to a biographer. And that's sort of why it's taken so long for a book like this to happen.
I really loved Harriet the Spy, too. And maybe it had something to do with my becoming a journalist. although it's not a book that I remember looking back on until you started talking about this. It's like, oh, yeah, I loved that book. And it's not one that somehow stuck with me. So I don't know anything about Louise Fitzhugh. And I don't know, did she write any other books? Did she have hits beyond that?
Well, there was a sequel to Harriet the Spy called The Long Secret. She also was a painter. I went to look up her New York Times obit when I was just starting the book. And, you know, basically it says she's a single woman survived by her mother, an artist, and children's book author. I mean, it's a very short, very short obit.
That's probably like a really interesting side project to go back and look at the obits of people who were gay or lesbian or bisexual or otherwise and see how that was handled back in the days of yore. I'm sure it was not always forthcoming.
It was completely avoided as a topic. I have a friend who has a tattoo from Harriet the Spy and on her arm, and it's what I think is Harriet's most famous quote, which is, when I grow up, I'm going to find out everything about everybody and put it in a book, which I love.
Do people still read Harriet the Spy, do you think?
Oh, yeah,
they do. And, you know, now, of course, librarians and educators love it as a book. I mean, it's really about self-reliance and growing up and, you know, a kid who copes really well with some of the ugly truths of the world. now it has a much different reputation.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. And now, of course, it's a beloved classic, you know,
right.
And any kind of, I mean, as happens with all children's literature over time, you know, the books that were extremely controversial when they came out, whether it's In the Night Kitchen or Shel Silverstein, you know, now these are the books that Gen X parents have embraced so wholeheartedly in that entire generation of teachers and librarians. And frankly, you know, I think that books that cause any kind of ripples among people for whatever reason, given the strong mission that most librarians feel is their role, it just causes them to embrace it all the more, you know. So there's a celebration of Banned Books Week. You know, it's not a period of mourning or introspection or, you know, questioning whether those books belong on the list or not. Like, no, it's read these books.
I should add as an aside that in the sea of sniffy reviews the book got when it came out, the Times' reviewer was Gloria Vanderbilt, who loved the book and gave it a rave.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Greg, what are you reading?
I'm reading the novel The Known World by Edward P. Jones. It's a historical novel set in Virginia in the decades just before the Civil War, although it moves around in time pretty fluidly. So it jumps ahead till after the Civil War and gives you flash forwards to characters' deaths and things like that. But primarily it tells the story of one plantation in a fictional county in Virginia in the decades before the Civil War, where the master of the plantation, the owner of some 30-odd slaves, is himself a former slave, a free black man whose father bought him out of slavery when he was a child. And the father worked as a carpenter and earned enough money with side jobs to buy first himself out of slavery, then his wife, then his son, and of course renounces slavery and is shocked when his son grows up to become a slave owner. That son, Henry Townsend, is kind of the central character that all the other characters revolve around in the book. This is a book, it won the Pulitzer Prize in, I think, 2004. It was picked as one of the top works of fiction since 1980 in a survey that the Book Review did back in the early 2000s. And then, of course, A.O. Scott just wrote about Edward P. Jones on our cover and his body of work. And so it's a book that I was very familiar with by reputation. And in our job, you often get to know a lot about a book and to know the discourse around a book without ever actually having read it. And so you feel like
the read around.
Yes. You're like, I know about that book. And so then you feel like you don't need to read it. But I picked this one up after Tony Scott's essay and fell so completely into it. He creates such an immersive world. He does what in science fiction they call world building, but here it's just, you know, the world. It's a world of historical fact, giving you every character's life, and always has a sense of slavery as the existing economic system. You know, it was kind of the most extreme form of capitalism in its day, with slaves as property, but also as status symbols. You know, the more slaves you had, it was like having a fancy car collection, and you'd pay less for this slave because she was crippled, or more for this one because he was intelligent, but you didn't want a slave who was too intelligent. And so there's always this sense that slavery is just the water that they're swimming in. It's, you know, nobody even questions whether there's another way of doing things. And it really gives you the life of the slaves on Henry Townsend's plantation. And Henry Townsend, we know from the beginning of the book, dies young. He dies in his early 30s. And life on the plantation kind of falls apart after that because he ruled with an iron hand. And you get a lot of how he was, as a black man who owned slaves, he had to be more careful and kind of stricter. He had less freedom to bend the rules of slavery because he already had a very tenuous position in there. And so he needed to cling to it with particular fierceness. And he comes under the tutelage of his former master, a white man named William Robbins, who kind of teaches him the ways of slaveholding. It's a fascinating book. It's a book that gets into a lot of moral nuance and complexity. Obviously, it's a horrific system that subjugates people, but there's a lot of room for joy, you know, just life to be lived under this incredibly oppressive, violent, murderous system. You get glimpses of the slave patrollers who are kind of a parallel to modern day police forces, and not a parallel that Jones himself belabors at all, but this whole idea of people brought in to enforce the rules. So it's just a riveting book. You have a character who's an artist in there. The title, The Known World, comes from this folk art that she does, kind of capturing the whole world, which again is clearly a parallel to what Jones is doing in the book. The book ends with an interview with Jones.
You're not going to give anything away, are you? To want to read this book, I have to say.
No, this is in the aftermatter of the book. There is an interview with Jones where the interviewer points out, you include census data, you include a lot of hard facts about this. Where did you find that stuff? And he says, I made it all up. I imagined the whole thing. He doesn't know hard data on how many free black slave owners there were, although he knows they did exist. The county is made up. These particular characters are all made up. And it's shocking because it's almost like reading just a historical account. It's that immersive. Pamela, what are you reading?
So I think I mentioned on a recent podcast that I only just recently, as in this year, started to read more than one book at a time. It's almost embarrassing to admit that. I don't know what took me so long. Like, you can watch a movie and a TV show, like you can watch more than two TV series at a time. But for some reason, I was always a very religiously monogamous reader. And I have to say, right now, I'm reading 4 books and I'm reading them all for very different reasons and in different ways. But it's too much. I've taken it too far. I went too far. So while I'm very slowly reading those 4 books, I'm going to talk about 2 books that I read now about a month ago, which were both by Tana French. One is Broken Harbor and the other is In the Woods. What happened with Tana French and me is that when her third most recent book came out, The Trespasser, that's when I started on Tana French. And I loved it so much, I went on to The Witch Elm. I haven't read her latest book yet, The Searcher. And the reason I haven't is that I thought, wait a minute, I've done this backwards. I'm going to start at the beginning. And so I did exactly that and went to her first book, In the Woods. And, you know, now having read this and Broken Harbor, and I didn't read them quite back to back. I think there were a couple of books in between. I'm really getting a feel. This is like, these are, I guess, my third and fourth Tana French, for sort of what she does and what makes her interesting. And one of the things that she does is that she really kind of, I don't want to say that she cheats the reader. It's not that, but she surprises you. She refuses to conform to certain expectations, reader expectations in thrillers. Like, she will have her main mystery and her sub mystery and then just never tell you what happened in the sub mystery. You know, it's left unsolved. And that happens in one of these 2 books. And I don't want to give it away because I don't want to upset anyone. But when it does, you're like, I was so surprised by it that, Tina, I think I turned to you and I said, am I missing something or did she never tell us what happened? And you're like, no, she never tells us. So you've read Tana French before, Tina. What are your thoughts?
I have. You know, unlike most thriller writers, the novels are really almost like psychological studies, right? That's what they are. You're inside the heads of, I'm thinking of Broken Harbor, which you're going to talk about next. You're just inside the heads of such different people. And you come away with an understanding of motivation, for example.
Yes.
You know, why people do the things they do. I'm very rarely surprised by the outcome.
But in a way, that's good, right? It's because she's not like doing what, you know, Agatha Christie would do upon occasion, where, you know, just kind of like bring someone out from the closet, you know, and be like, all along, it has been this person that we have never met.
Yeah, right, right. No, she's not strewing the plot with red herrings. To me, anyway, it becomes clear while I'm reading, but that doesn't take away from the enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I mean, Broken Harbor doesn't immediately follow In the Woods. I think there's a book or two in between. I stopped going strictly in order after In the Woods because I think I asked a couple of hardcore Tana French fans which was the best, their favorite. And a number of people said it was Broken Harbor. Is that one of your favorites, Tina?
That's my favorite.
Okay. Well, then I want to turn it to you. Like, what makes it your favorite?
It is the most chilling and accurate description of somebody's descent into madness that I've ever read.
Yes, yes, yes. And probably a very, this is a good time, well, either a good time or a horrible time to read it, because it's sort of really what happens to people when they're unemployed.
Right. It's a young couple living in a subdivision that's sort of gone belly up. Most of the houses are empty. They've lost their jobs. They have two children, and the husband starts to hear animals in the walls, and he's convinced he hears them.
And what's interesting, again, as a kind of psychological novel, is that you as the reader, for a while, you don't really know. You know, you can easily get drawn into his imagined world. And the early setup in this book is really horrifying. You know, there's a house where two children are found dead by suffocation. A husband is dead. The wife and mother is very seriously wounded and possibly going to die, and you don't know. And there are a number of baby monitors strewn around the house in strategic places, and holes taken out of the walls, and a monitor pointing up to the attic. So you just look at the scene and have no idea what's happened here.
You forgot the trap.
Oh, yes. But tell us about the trap.
Well, there's some trap set for some immense animal. Like, you don't know what that's about.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, I mean, yes. And, you know, one of the funny, I mean, there's humor in her novels, too. And these are set in Dublin, and there's a lot of kind of like Irish character and lingo that is a source of humor, for at least for me. You know, just I sort of wish I were, you know, a gritty Irish cop just to be able to talk like one. But one of the sources of humor in this book is that this trap that's found is subject to discussion on an internet board. And, you know, some people on this internet board, which is like devoted to the trapping of unwanted animals, this is just like the kind of medieval torture system of traps that like no reasonable person would ever bring this kind of trap into their home unless like they thought the abominable snowman was in there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's run down the titles of what we read again. Tina.
I read Sometimes You Have to Lie, The Life and Times of Louise Fitzhugh, renegade author of Harriet the Spy by Leslie Brody.
I read The Known World by Edward P. Jones.
And I read Tana French's Broken Harbor and In the Woods. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.